Would someone read 17 of chapter 5, Matthew's Gospel? Just read it out loud.
Do not think... Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead, Jackie.
Do not think I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them.
That's a key verse, probably the key verse in the Gospel according to Matthew. Law and prophets, Torah and prophets. Torah is the first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and the prophets would be the writings of the prophets, a much larger section. In other words, I have come to fulfill the Scriptures. This was the Hebrew Bible. Now, the wisdom writings were in circulation, had been collected, were formed, and so forth. But the people still referred to their Scriptures, the Hebrew Bible, as the Law and the Prophets. And so when he says that, that's what he's talking about. I have come to not to do away with the Scripture, but to fulfill it. And in particular, he's talking about the Torah, because in the Jewish way of thinking, the Torah is central in their relationship with God. The prophets interpret the Torah. The wisdom writings interpret the Torah. Everything is about the Torah. God has made Himself, has made His Word, has made His will known in the Torah. And so the prophets are pointing to the Torah and interpreting for the people in a time in which they've apostatized. The wisdom tradition is pointing to the Torah and interpreting it. Now, for Matthew, Jesus is the true teacher of Israel. Moses was the teacher of Israel. Moses was the one, you remember, who received the Decalogue, the 10 words, from which the Torah grew. And so Moses was the teacher, and Moses was the interpreter of the Torah. Now, I will say law, but I don't want you to put that in terms of our legislation. Think of it as teaching. You're to keep the Sabbath holy. Well, we need to understand that. Interpret that for us and help us to live that. And so you need teaching. This is the teaching about the Sabbath. You need that. And so you have to have a teacher. You have to have an interpreter. Interpretation is what a teacher does. And so Moses was that. The prophets were that. And now there are rabbis all around when Jesus steps onto the scene. They are the teachers. They're the ones who've studied and so forth. They're the ones who are in that tradition of teaching and interpreting and so forth. Matthew says Jesus comes onto the scene among teachers, but is not to be seen as another rabbi. He is the true teacher of Israel, even greater than Moses. He is the true interpreter of the Torah. So he's like in the prophetic tradition, but he exceeds it. He fulfills it. He's like in the rabbinic tradition, except he's greater than that. He exceeds that. He fulfills that. And so it's extremely important that we understand that Jesus did not come to do away with any of that that had gone before and that is written down as Scripture. Now, Paul has a different interpretation. It's as though Jesus has come to be the end of the law. And now we're in Christ and not in the law. I'm not going to go into that and compare and so on. What we just want to be focused on is that for Matthew, Jesus is the true teacher of Israel. So much so that Matthew's gospel has five discourse sections. Five that most scholars believe reflect the fivefold structure of the Torah. First five books. Not that one refers to, I mean, or is related to Genesis and another is related to Exodus. It's not that. It's just, it's the pattern. It's the fivefold pattern. And there are five discourses, and I have on your outline, under E, the true teacher of Israel, I have the five sections. The first we know of as the Sermon on the Mount. The second, instruction on the teaching, healing mission of the disciples. Chapter 10, but going right into verse 1 of chapter 11. And then there's a discourse section on parables of the kingdom, chapter 13. There is a discourse section on advice to a divided community, chapter 17 and 18. And then a discourse on the end of the age and judgment. Five discourse sections. And what that means is a discourse, conversation, presentation orally. Jesus' articulation, Jesus' interpretation. These are sayings that have been collected. It's not like one day he did one discourse section and then he waited and another day did discourse section number two. These are compilations of sayings. And they just, you can see how they pile together. You read the Sermon on the Mount, they just pile together. And in between the discourse sections are narrative sections. They fill in between them. Narrative being story. So you've got a story section, opening Matthew's gospel. Then you've got the Sermon on the Mount discourse. Then you've got a narrative section that starts in chapter 8. He cleanses a leper, heals a centurion servant, heals many. In other words, you're telling the story, whatever, until you get to the second discourse, which is instruction on the teaching, healing mission of the disciples. Then after that discourse, you have another narrative section and so forth. That's the way Matthew's gospel is structured. The whole point being that Jesus is the true teacher of Israel. Now, some have said that Matthew wants to portray him as the new Moses, as a replacement, or one who comes in the position of Moses and yet is greater. And there may be some truth in that, but don't get into the word new too much. For example, Jesus says here, I do not come to do away with. In other words, I do not come to bring a new law. There is no new law. It's the same one. I just come to interpret it. But don't even say, I come to bring a new interpretation. That sounds like a replacement. He's not coming to replace it. He's coming to interpret it. He's coming to fulfill it. So it's not a new teaching. You know, he'll be accused of that. What is this new teaching you have? You don't teach as our scribes do. It's not a new teaching. It's just, it's new to you because you don't recognize it. It's been there since the very beginning. It's the Torah. And you're supposed to be people of the Torah, and you've studied in your synagogues, and you've used it in worship, and you've been so soaked and steeped in it. But guess what? You don't even recognize it. All I'm doing is bringing the Torah and the true interpretation. Now, what's so important about this is the Messiah was believed by expectation to be an interpreter of the Torah. And everyone anticipated what that interpretation might be. You follow? That when the Messiah came, he would exceed all the rabbis and all the scribes. He would exceed all of the prophets. And he would come with the true interpretation of the Torah. That was an expectation. You may never have heard that, but that is an expectation. You know, they expect even today in the Jewish community that the Messiah will come with an interpretation, the true interpretation of the Torah. Yes?
Doesn't that sort of imply also that the previous interpreters haven't been getting it exactly right?
Well, they're falling short. Doesn't mean they're wrong necessarily, but you know, it's like they're getting parts of it, but it's dim. You know, you're not seeing in full. So now it's going to be in full. It's like with the Transfiguration, Moses and Elijah are in the light. They're illuminaries. You know, they're history's lights, bright lights, the brightest there's ever been. And now there's a light that exceeds it.
But in Jesus' time, though, there the Pharisees, etc.
There were those
very clearly wrong.
Well, there were faults, yeah. But don't take all of the rabbis and all of the Pharisees and all of the scribes as wrong. And Jesus coming to correct them. That's an image we get. Yeah. It's the false against the true. No, that is in part. But the bigger part is it's the true interpretation against the lesser. You know, here is the one by which all interpretations will now be measured. And they did have, like we do too, we have certain authorities that stand out above other authorities. And so their word is that by which you evaluate another authority's word. And it was, this is the one in his or her field that has the more authoritative interpretation of whatever that field is. So all lesser authorities kind of submit to that or battle with that. But nonetheless, what they're saying is we've had authorities, we've had luminaries, we've had interpretations that have been good, strong, true interpretations in part. But we're going to get the truth, the full interpretation when the Messiah comes. And so Matthew has Jesus stepping into that messianic role, being the true teacher of Israel, the true interpreter of the Torah. He's bringing that interpretation. And so you read the teachings of Jesus here in that light.
Well, if Jesus hadn't come, the Gentiles would never have heard. They were not included.
They were supposed to be.
But they weren't.
No. And that's one of the false interpretations, or the lower interpretations. The reason the blessing was given to Abraham was that all nations would be blessed. We're going to talk about that a little bit later in this that we're dealing with Matthew. But, you know, that light wasn't going out because Israel's light was going out. That's two ways of understanding going out. Their light wasn't going out because their light was dimming and not shining. Their interpretation of Torah needed to be illumined, needed to be full. Then the light would go out to the nations. They did not see it as the Messiah would replace the Torah and His light would go out to the world. This is the light of God that has been made known fully in the Torah. And there is no brighter source here for the nations, certainly for Israel first, but you've got to have the Messiah to fully show that. You remember when Moses came off the mountain, his face was shining, it was so bright, scared the Israelites, and so he had to put a veil over it. And Paul picks up on that in 2 Corinthians 4 when he talks about, we now preach the gospel with faces unveiled, so that the light, the God who said, let there be light in the beginning, will now shine, the glory of God will now shine through Jesus Christ and so forth. So in other words, they view the Messiah that way. The Messiah will come and it will be unveiled, and the true light of the Torah, the true light of God, will be made known to Israel and then may be made known to all the nations. So that's how this should be understood. Now, Matthew never questions the validity of the law. The issue is the interpretation. And what will that interpretation be once the Messiah has come? Again, it's not a new Torah, it's not a new interpretation, he's not a new teacher, he is the true teacher of the true law, the true interpretation of it, and so forth. Now, there is a little bit of a problem with what Matthew is presenting to us. And I'll take you, if you will, to... let me see if I've got... I think it's 1 John. But let's go to John 13. Yes. John 13, 34 to 35. John 13, 34 to 35. Now, this is what we have heard and been taught in our upbringing. I give you a new commandment. I thought Jesus did not come to give a new Torah, a new law, a new commandment, a new teaching. I give you a new commandment that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also should love one another. And by this, everyone will know you are my disciples if you have love for one another. And we've seized on that. What do you do with that? You see the tension? Matthew 5:17, Jesus says, I've come not to do away with the law, I've come to fulfill it. And here he says, I give you a new commandment. Now, of course, someone might say, well, what he's doing is he's adding something. You know, whereas in the Hebrew mind, the Torah is the fullness of the light of God, the glory of God, the fullness of the knowledge of God, the fullness of the will of God. You can't add to it. If you can add to it, then it was falling short itself. Let's go to in the Johannine corpus. What's the Johannine corpus? Body. That's a lawyer for you. He knows what corpus is. What's Johannine?
John.
What writings would be in the Johannine corpus? Revelation, the Apocalypse of John. Somebody say Gospel of John. Good? There.
Letters of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd.
Yes, the letters of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John. I knew I was in the right place when I went to Southern Seminary, and I was single when I went. That didn't last long. When I went to Southern Seminary, and I went on the dorm floor and went into the restroom, there were three stalls, 1st John, 2nd John. I knew I was home. This is a biblical place. There was a lot of that going on all the time. Anyway, let's go to 1 John 2:8. See, y'all know, you get it, that Johannine corpus. All right, 1 John 2:8. Or 2:7. Let's go to 2:7. Now, again, remember, we're still in the Johannine corpus. You remember what I just read out of the Gospel of John? Well, here it says, Beloved, I am, and this is John speaking, I am writing you no new commandment, but an old commandment that you've had from the beginning. And the old commandment is the word that you've heard. Yet I am writing you a new commandment that is true in him and in you, because the darkness is passing away and the true light is already shining. There, I mean, John puts the tension right there in those two verses. I'm writing you an old commandment. It's been there from the beginning. But I'm giving you a new commandment. Is that just a way of saying Jesus interprets the Torah? It is new to you? Is that what he's saying? It's an old commandment, but yet in him it's new. In other words, not new in terms of replacement, but just new in terms of fulfillment. Is that what he's trying to say? At least that would be consistent to Matthew.
The way I think of it is an interpretation that just crystallizes everything before.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah,
that's a good way of putting it. But when you say, when on the lips of Jesus in John's Gospel, I've come to give you a new commandment, new doesn't necessarily mean what new means to us. In other words, we take it as, oh, a brand new. The Jewish people didn't have that commandment. We're going to see in a moment that they indeed did. It's very old. But Jesus, I like your crystallization, as he's crystallizing it, as he's putting it together, giving the true interpretation, this one stands out in a way that it did not stand out before. Doesn't mean it wasn't there. Doesn't mean it wasn't binding. And Jesus is not giving a new one. It was already there. Now that would be in keeping with a Hebraic mindset. That's the way they would understand it. You got to be careful, because what we tend to do is we tend to bifurcate and we say, okay, all of that's done with, all of that's past, you know, and Jesus comes with a new law. And He comes with a new commandment to love each other, because they didn't love each other. And they weren't under God's will to do that. And yet we are. So the Old Testament's a testament of violence and oppression, and the New Testament's a testament of liberation and freedom, and, you know, and that is totally wrong. Just totally wrong.
Yeah, I think what he was getting at is if you will love each other as you're supposed to, you won't do any of these other things that the previous statements of the law.
Right. If you love one another, you're fulfilling the Torah. And he's just bringing it out. It's kind of like it's been there, but it just hadn't been brought out. You know, and that's all he's doing. He's not putting he's not adding something, as we tend to have been told, and that's the way we interpret it. And I'll give you one more, 2 John 1:5. But now, dear lady, I ask you, not as though I were writing you a new commandment, but one we have had from the beginning, let us love one another. And this is love, that we walk according to His commandments. And this is the commandment, just as you've heard it from the beginning, you must walk in it. Well, His commandments is not Jesus has given a new body of commandments. It's that Jesus is giving the interpretation of the commandments that have been from the beginning. And we, just like Israel, we walk in those commandments. That's what He's saying. It's, again, not to be interpreted as a replacement or something that does away with the law. Now, let's go to Matthew 22. By the way, if you have any questions or want to stop me, by all means do so. I want to make sure you get this.
This was written after Jesus had been rejected and killed. Was it somewhat of a defense also, given what happened?
Yeah, definitely in Matthew's Gospel. Yeah. Now, I will say one other thing about John's Gospel. When you go to John's Gospel, what John does with Christology is what has been made known, he presents it as if it were self-evident. He presents it as if it was on the lips of Jesus and it was just out there. There's no messianic secret like you've got in Mark. You know, where Jesus is teaching and doing miracles, and yet you kind of go, wait a minute, this is ambiguous. This isn't self-evident. Who do you say that Jesus is? It's not that at all. And John, everything just, you know, blares out. And so, you have to be careful interpreting John, because John just takes Christology and makes it explicit. Now, that's later. John's Gospel is later, into the first century, maybe even into the second century. The other Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, are at least probably 35 or 40 to 50 years, maybe a little bit more, after the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And so Christology has evolved or developed, but and it is somewhat polemical in relation to the temple, in relation to the teachers of Israel. And that's what you're asking. It is, yeah. In other words, Matthew's Gospel particularly. I mean, it's not like he's trying to attack the teachers of Israel, but there is this, I want to make the point that Jesus is the true interpreter because he's the Messiah. So it is directed there, at least in part, major part. Now let's go to chapter 22, verse 34. You know the story. The Pharisees heard that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees. They gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. And by the way, a lawyer does not mean what lawyer means today. This is a teacher. Lawyer, Torah. This is a teacher. So one of the teachers asked him a question to test him. That's what teachers do. They give tests. And then he calls Jesus teacher. Setting him up, of course. You know, we acknowledge that you're a teacher. You're one of the guild. So let me ask you a question. And that's what scholars love to do. If you go into the academic community and they have a guest scholar to come and do a lecture, they love to let the grad students go first and try to pick at and find a problem or whatever. And then the scholars, the teachers, the professors, love to, you know, dig into, well, in your writing, this and this, you said this and this and this and this. So it's a certain gamesmanship. But, teacher, which commandment in the law is the greatest? Which commandment in the Torah is the greatest? Now, this was a common question. This was asked to not get at the greatest, the most important. It's get at the one that is first. And all others fall and flow from it. What is the center of the Torah? What's the core? Or, what's the beginning of the Torah? Summarize it in the briefest possible way. Can you put it in one commandment which says all the commandments? Can you put in one statement the whole Torah? And this was, you know, get down to the bottom line kind of thing. What's the bottom line here? What's the essence? This was a common question, and every rabbinic person attempted to do that. And each one would have a slight variation of it to give to his students. This is the greatest commandment. So they're coming to Jesus and going, I haven't yet heard you say what you think is the core interpretation. What do you think is the beginning or the source of the Torah? What kind of capsulizes all of it? Puts it in a nutshell? What is that? And Jesus responds, and you know this, he responds, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. And all your mind is an addition. And this is the greatest and first commandment. By the way, it also is the first commandment of the Ten Commandments. When you think about it, there is God, and only God is God, and you're to love God, you're to worship God, you're to have no other gods. That's the very beginning. And all he's doing is quoting that. All he's doing is saying, that's the center, that's the start of this. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. What's the law and the prophets? The Torah and the prophets. It's their scriptures. It's their body of... That's what they use as the term for their Bible. So, this is summarizing it. Everything hangs on these two commandments. And so in giving one, Jesus gives two. Now, I'm going to show you where these are. And what I want you to be noting is they're not together in the Torah. Okay? Let's go to Deuteronomy 6:4. One of my favorite chapters. Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. One of my favorite chapters, as I said. Let's go to verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. Jesus says mind. Don't make too big a deal of that. It's not, oh, wait a minute. In the Old Testament, I get to love the Lord with my heart and soul and might. I don't have to do it with my mind. I don't have to do that. What it's saying is, love the Lord your God with your whole self. The Hebrews did not divide the human being into parts like we do. We come off the Greek tradition that did this dividing. And the big division was between, you heard me say this in the sermon last week, the big division in Greek thinking is between the material body and the immaterial soul or spirit. The fleshly body and the spiritual soul. And we think that way, which is totally wrong in terms of the Bible. Totally wrong. Totally. There's not anywhere close. I used to try to be kinder, but I don't have time. I'm getting old. In the Hebrew Bible, the human being is made up of what? Go back to creation. The human being is made up of what? Dust, dirt, stuff, material. Nothing but material except the breath of God. Very good. And so in the Hebrew way of thinking, all you are is a pile of dust, dirt. And you're going to go back to dust and dirt, all of you. There's nothing eternal about you. You're not God. You think you are, but you're not. You're not immortal. There's nothing immortal in you or about you whatsoever, except God inflates you. He animates you. You are a living being because of the continual breath of God. That's why Pentecost is important to the church, because the church, the disciples are nothing but dirt. They're nothing but dust until the wind stirs it up and embraces it and it becomes a living body, the church. I remember Jesus talking to Nicodemus in John 3, and Nicodemus said, "I don't get this stuff." And Jesus says, "You know, you got to be born of the Spirit." He says, "I don't get that." "Well, how could you not? You're a teacher of Israel, aren't you? What's wrong with you? Where have you been?" The wind blows where it wills. The wind inflates. The wind animates. So that's, and then of course, death is in Hebrew thinking, is when God withdraws His breath, and you do not have the breath any longer to praise God, which is the horror of Sheol. So, let's leave that aside. What it's saying here is, your whole self loves God. The love, and love is not, I'm in love with God. Again, we need almost another word, because love has been destroyed in our language and our culture. So, it's, you know, I give myself. I offer sacrificially myself. I worship God. I heart, mind, soul, body, hands, feet, you name it, I'm wholly in. You know, it's like a hokey pokey. You put your right hand in, you put everything in. That's what this is about. This is called the Shema, S-H-E-M-A. It was recited then, and it's recited today by Orthodox Jews, daily. And so Jews in Jesus' time would have every single day, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might." In Deuteronomy, it goes on to say, you are to keep these words. That means obey them, live this way, walk in them. You are to recite them to your children. You're to talk with your children about them. You're to teach your children. When you rise up in the morning, you're to say it. And when you lie down at night, you're to say it. The Shema is to be repeated. You're to put them as a sign on your hand, as an emblem on your forehead. The box. I was watching the news this week of the tragedy in Israel and the terrorist attack, and all the men are standing around with the boxes. You're to write it on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. In other words, your whole life, your family, your children, everything. You know, as for me and my house, we love the Lord our God. You know, that you're to put it on your doorpost, on your gate. You keep going. Put it in your kitchen. Put it in your bathroom. Put it in your bedroom. Put it in your hallway. Put it in that closet that's just packed out with stuff. Put it in the attic with the. You don't need to do that. You just say, put it in your family, your house, and whatever, whatever. This is who we are. This is how we live. Now, you do not see anywhere here to love your neighbor as yourself. So, go to Leviticus 19. You go back in the Old Testament. Leviticus 19. We are now in what is called the Holiness Code. There are several holiness codes. And this is one of them, one of the major ones. Leviticus 19 and go to 17. By the way, the Holiness Code extends from 17:1 all the way to the end of 26. So it's a very lengthy code. And it's about ritual, moral holiness. Now, you shall not hate in your heart any one of your kin. You shall reprove your neighbor, or you will incur guilt yourself. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against any of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. And there it is. It is not combined as Jesus does it. What Jesus does when asked about the greatest is he takes the first commandment, the primary, the starting, the core, the central, everything hangs on this, and then he takes this one out of the Holiness Code and he puts it with it. Now notice he says there are two commandments. They go together. Now I will emphasize that because what we tend to do is collapse the first one into the second one as if it's the same. You know, and we say, well, we got it from Jesus. Jesus said, if you do it unto the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. So therefore, to love God, you love one another. In fact, loving one another is loving God. No, it's not. If you love God, you will love your neighbor. But they're not saying the same thing. One is directed to God and the other is directed to neighbor. Your relation to God and your relation to neighbor, they're tied in together, and Jesus is doing that, but you cannot substitute one for the other, particularly not go with the second one, which is if you collapse the first one into it, which is essentially the way I know God and serve God. And I read this in the in books, or I read it in the newspaper on the faith and values section all the time, that the real way you love God is you love one another. Well, you collapse it, you basically have humanism. Just pure, straight out humanism. God told me to do this, to be a humanist, but that's the way that I know that I'm of God, is because I'm a humanist. I'm a humanitarian. That is not biblical religion. That is not Christian religion. You love the Lord your God with all your heart and all yourself and so on, and you love your neighbor as yourself. Okay, let's look more closely before we move on. Jacqueline?
Because my mind is one is vertical, one is horizontal.
Right. Love the Lord your God and love one another. And both axes are important. These axes are to be structured, but you cannot collapse this one into this one. Nor escape this one because you've got this one. Okay. Just listen, you'll hear people say it all the time. They don't know what they're saying, but I'm afraid that's what they mean. Okay, let's look at these verses a little more carefully. You shall not hate in your heart any one of your kin. And in the same verse, your neighbor. And in the next verse, any of your people. That same verse, 18, neighbor is repeated. Kin, neighbor, people. What is the reference? Who's your kin? Who's your people? Who's your neighbor? God's people. The people of God. The Israelites. That's what's being said here. Nowhere does Jesus ever speak of universal love. Always, when the statement is made to love your neighbor is your fellow Israelite. It's your family member. It's your kin. It's your people. That's what the reference is, consistently. Now, I'm going to come back and I'm going to talk about love of all humankind and of all nations later. I'm saying the commandment is to love one another in Israel. When it's a church, to love one another in the community of faith. That's what the reference is. What we've done in our congregations as we've been growing up is to spin it into a universal love ethic. And in other words, you substitute that and do away with what we're talking about that the Bible actually presents. Okay? So, do away with that. I just keep telling you to throw stuff out, don't I? Because if I don't, you're just going to keep using it and misinterpreting. So follow with me. You shall not hate in your heart your brother and your sister and your uncle and your aunt, the tribe of Benjamin of which you're a part. You're not to hate anyone, and you're not to hate the next tribe member either. It enlarges not just your own tribe. You know, I like my people, but not your... No, we are the people of God, and so you love the other person who's in the people of God. That's your neighbor. That's your neighbor. You're not to bear a grudge against any of your people. Okay? As yourself, this is not to be interpreted individualistically. We have been taught that there's God, your neighbor, and yourself, which is me. That's wrong. Throw that out. Just get rid of that one too. We just need a big barrel over here, don't we? Just throw these things in there. That is not what yourself is referring to. It is more collective. As you love your own family, as you are intensely concerned about your people, your own household, you relate to everyone in that solidarity, that greater unity. Yourself is no self apart from that community. You only have identity as a part of a community that has identity. And that's why it's so difficult for those who are outcast. We're going to hear about lepers this morning in worship. They were outcast, which is extremely devastating and destructive because they have no identity. It's like they've been disowned. We don't mind it. We're such individualists that, you know, we go, I, me, myself, and then I'll work up some love for you, my neighbor, and maybe work up some for God. When actually this works, you're only a part of a larger community. It's not you love yourself so much that you need to spread some of that love around to some other people. That's the way we interpret it. And by the way, we do not live in a culture where people love themselves. They hate themselves. Compensating, that's my psychologist hat on, compensating and overcompensating with this extreme egotism, self-centeredness, selfishness, and so forth. They don't love themselves. In other words, they're not part of a community where there is such love that is not like me and then you. It's a community. You don't lose yourself, but you certainly are not focused on yourself. So don't read this individualistically. Read it in the context of this community. And in this community, there is God, and there is neighbor, and there is yourself. And it is a community that is characterized by loving the Lord your God with your whole self, loving your neighbor with your whole self, and in that community, you are included. Because there is a love in this community that is embracing you and giving you your identity. That is a much better way to interpret it. There's a solidarity. These are your brothers and sisters in the faith.
It's not me, it's we.
It is we, but me is in the we. Not we and in me. See, we tend to think, you know, God, and then we've got neighbor, and then there's me. And everything works from me to my neighbor and to God. So I'll love God first with me, and I'll love my neighbor with me, and then I'll love me. That's not even the way we do it. The way we do it is, I got all this love for me. I just need to spread it around. And you know, quit being so selfish. You need to treat other people like you want to be treated. Oh, okay, I love myself. I need to treat them like I treat myself. See how self-centered it becomes. And then I'll love God. I'll spread my love to God. And God will love me so much for that. See how what we do? It works from God down. Only your neighbor is your neighbor because of love for God. It's the others who love God. Right now, it's not included in here those who hate God. Those who do not know God. They're not yet included in this community. Your neighbor is the person who loves God with you, enabling you. And you find your identity in that community of neighbors. Okay?
So if you're spending your time loving God properly, you won't have time to mistreat your neighbors.
Well, what it's saying is, here is a community of people, the people of God who love God. And as the people of God, loving God, they love one another. It's just part of it. And therefore, you're loved. Therefore, you love. And there's, you participate in love. You're not the source of it. You're not the objective of it.
You're the result of it?
Yeah. Probably a good way to put it. Right. You're a result of the community in relation to God. And so therefore, you don't hold a grudge against your brother, your sister, your neighbor in this love of God. And again, right now we're still in this territory of those who love and serve God, who repeat the Shema. Okay? Now, let's go down to verse 33. Chapter 19 of Leviticus. When an alien resides with you in your land, you shall not oppress the alien. The alien who resides with you shall be to you as the citizen among you. You shall love the alien as yourself, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. The solidarity is expanded to include resident aliens, not foreigners who are traveling through, and not to wider humanity. In other words, if they're in Israel, you respect and support everyone. You extend hospitality. And you go, well, is that just what happened this week with the immigrants being... Let's set that one aside. We'll bog down. Think about it. In that time, and it still is in large parts of the world this way, you don't have borders. You don't have... You know, there's always... And there's a fight about the borders if you do try to establish them. And, of course, invading armies and that kind of thing. And so, people are... You know, Israel was in the midst of Canaan as resident alien people. And And if you are the ones who are residing, and there's a resident alien among you, you extend hospitality. It's just simply broadening out. It's not just those who love the Lord their God with all their heart that are in the people of God. It begins to also be resident alien. And by the way, this is also reflected in the Sabbath commandment. It is not just you, but it's anyone who's in your household. And by the way, your animals too. Your animals observe the Sabbath. You let them. You make them. In other words, you don't take your mules out and plow the fields. In fact, your land participates in the Sabbath keeping. You remember?
So you still have to milk the cow.
Yeah, well, yeah. Or milk it late before the Sabbath begins and hope the cow can last. You see, now you need an interpreter. You need a teacher to help you interpret in the Torah what this means about keeping the Sabbath when it comes to your milking cows. In other words, it applies to everything as well as everybody in the people of God. So if you have servants, your servants, you know, for example, was it Cornelius? Remember Cornelius in the book of Acts? And he's converted. And his whole household is baptized. In other words, there's a solidarity. And so you start out with love your neighbor, which is love your fellow Israelite. Well, love every person in the realm of Israel, even if they don't belong to Israel. You'll extend the hospitality. Now, this is extremely important because of something that you have to have in mind. But to get to it, I've got to talk about loving your enemy. If you go to Matthew, let's go back to Matthew. Matthew 5:38. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I say, do not resist an evildoer. Go down to 43. You've heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. In the time in which Jesus lived, in fact, centuries before, this was common tradition. You help your neighbors and you harm your enemies. The Greek poet Hesiod in the 8th century BCE said, be friends with the friendly and visit him who visits you. Give to one who gives, but do not give to one who does not give. The emphasis is on mutual, or on balanced mutuality. In other words, if this person does good to you, you do good to that person. If this person does bad to you, it's in your right to do bad to that person. It's mutual. It's balanced. And what I just read quickly in verse 38, there was what was called lex talionis. It's the law of retaliation. In that part of the world, and by the way, you still find this in many cultures, if someone comes and steals your chicken, all bets are off and you can do whatever you want to that person. You can go steal their family members. You can kill them if you want to. But lex talionis, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, means if someone steals your chicken, the most you can do to retaliate is steal his chicken.
Limited vengeance.
Now, yeah, limited vengeance, right. Now, Tom, we could talk about whether or not there needs to be some compensation for the emotional toll and whatever and that kind of thing. But you see where lex talionis, an eye for an eye and tooth for tooth, was a tempering. And so if your enemy takes out your eye, you can, in your legal right, go take the eye out of your neighbor. If you have a tooth that's been knocked out because the guy slugged you, You can go slug him and knock his one tooth out. You can't knock two. If you knock two out, he gets to knock one of yours out. That's kind of like a bad haircut. You got too much out here, you got, you know. So, lex talionis and is the interpretation of the Torah by this point. Someone to whom an injustice has been done is entitled to do injustice in return, but measured, limited. It's equal justice. And by the way, don't make too much of this comment. It's off the hand comment, but we might need to have a little more lex talionis today to help us. Anyway, you can take that for what it's worth. It's a pretty common sense kind of thing, isn't it? Okay. Now, that's the practice that's behind verse 38. The practice behind 43 is the one I quoted from the Greek poet, be friends with the friendly, then don't be friends with the one who's not friendly. If they do you harm, you can do them harm. A Greek poet in the 7th century said, I know how to love those who love me, and I know how to hate them. My enemies I overwhelm with abuse. And that's the normal, typical kind of response. Now, Jesus is picking that up and saying, the Torah teaches to love your neighbor. Now, the Torah extends the neighbor to anyone who is in the realm of the people of God. Even if they're not of the people of God, you extend hospitality. Now, what about an enemy? Well, the enemy, first of all, is your neighbor. The enemy is not someone who is foreign. The commandment begins with someone with whom you have become an enemy. I always like these shows like 48 Hours and others that are dealing with the mysteries of why there was a murder and so forth. And they always ask the family and friends, can you think of anyone who had a problem with your loved one? Can you think of anyone who would want to... No, not at all. She had no enemies whatsoever. Well, she does have one. We don't know who it is yet. But hopefully by the end of the show, we'll know who it is. But see, we're not honest about enemies. The psalmist was. God, I got enemies. I hate them. I think we all deal with them. You know, you got to be aware of and confessional about your enemies before you can deal with this kind of commandment. Right? I mean, if you don't have any enemies, you can't certainly extend hospitality or love to them. You can't pray for them because you don't have any. Right? Now, again, this is not out there and about in the world. This is right here at home. In your own home, you have an enemy. Why do you think Thanksgiving is already causing so much anxiety among people? It's because they're going to get together with their family. I mean, you mean we're going to all have to get in the same house together? And then do it at Christmas? Oh my goodness. What I'm saying is, all is not well in the people of God. It's not this love of God and love of neighbor, and I'm in this community of love. It's being broken. And so, how do you deal with that? What do you do with that? You first of all got to admit that's where you are. The enemy is your neighbor. I'm not worried about somebody breaking into my house who lives on the other side of the world. Not now. I'm more worried about the people who live up the street, who are my neighbors. That's why I lock my doors. Right? In other words, you've got to think closer to home. And that's where this commandment starts. If the commandment is interpreted, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and if the commandment is interpreted, you can love those who love you, but you can heap abuse on those who abuse you, then something has to be dealt with here. How do you behave? And it essentially turns around to, you behave to your enemy, who's a neighbor, like that enemy is a neighbor. This is how you do it. Now I'm going to leave you there. And we'll pick up next week right there. So you just hang on that until we come back together and I will explain it further.